Vectis Radio, FM 104.6, the heart of the island's community.
So, welcome to Tuesday's Lunchtime Social. In the studio, we have Toby. Just bring yourself up closely to that microphone there, Toby.
Yep.
You all right?
Yep.
Yep. And we've also got... It is Martin, isn't it? I'm dreadful with names. Here you go, Martin. Pull yourself up a little bit closer to that microphone.
Yep.
All right. Don't eat it. it's Martin Woodward.
That's right.
Okay, and you are from the Isle of Wight Shipwreck Centre. Is that the correct...
Yeah, Shipwreck Centre and Maritime Museum at Arrowton Barnes.
And how long have you been there, then?
How long? Yeah. We've been at Arrowton for 12 years, but before that we were in Bembridge for 28 years. So this is our 40th anniversary since we opened.
Wow. Yeah. That's incredible. So you moved, I didn't even realise that you were going that long, but you moved from Bembridge to Arrowton.
We had to move from Bembridge because the parking got so restricted there.
Right.
But we were there 28 years, so up until 2005.
Crikey. So have you been there? Is it yours? Is it all down?
Yes, I've been there since the start, basically. So.
Wow. Yeah. So you've got some stories to tell. And we're hopefully going to get a few stories today, then.
You can have as many as you want.
So let's go back to the beginning, shall we?
Yeah.
If everybody's like listening and sat down cross-legged, you know, so it started when?
1977, sort of acquired an old baker and bin shop relict. I'd always start a museum because I couldn't get in my house because it was full of treasures from the deep, because I'm a diver by trade and I was working on shipwrecks and salvage work, and got very possessive about the stuff, didn't want to part with it because it was local heritage. So I had all this stuff in the house, and people used to come in and say, "You know, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, one day, to create a bit of space in here, I'm going to start a little museum." And it basically started from that. Then we acquired this building in 77, converted it June 1978 we opened, and we've been open ever since, basically.
Wow. Yeah. I'm just, because honestly, when John said you're coming in and talk about the Shipwreck Centre, I thought, okay, that'll be fine. And then there's so much more to this, isn't there? There's a man that goes, how far do you dive down? What's the furthest you've been down?
Oh, furthest I've been down is about 600 feet. But that's in the North Sea when I was commercial diving up there, doing the deep diving on the rigs. But basically around here, it's more or less up to about 150 feet, which is about the level that you can do on compressed air.
So how far, I'm guessing you dived around Newport, around the Isle of Wight many times.
Yeah.
I'm always wondering, how deep is it in certain places? Well, you'd be sort of the person to ask, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it varies a lot. I mean, close in, we tend to do a lot of close in work nowadays because a lot of the sailing ships wrecked on the back of the island because it was a lee shore, what they call a lee shore, that faced the prevailing wind. So they got blown in there by the wind when they couldn't sail offshore. So there's a lot of material inside, but we also did all the steamship wrecks, where if you go out probably half a mile and then from there on it gets down to about 100 feet, or I should talk metres here because there's everybody, a lot of people won't think in feet.
This is what really frustrates me, when, you know, they'll sell you a tape measure with it all on. If they wanted you to start thinking not feet and let's talk metric, well, don't put it on tape measures then.
They're thinking of us old people, that's what it is. But yeah, when you get offshore, it can go down about 100 feet, about 30 metres, and then further off about 50 metres. But it doesn't go down really deep except for St. Catherine's Deep, which goes down to about 60, 70 metres around that. So we did a lot of the steamship wrecks in the 60s and 70s. Got most of the offshore stuff done, and I still do a lot inshore, further in now. It's fascinating.
Honestly, I'm fascinated by it, and I guess the reason why I'm fascinated by it is because we don't know, and we explore what's on the top, but we never ever look, unless we're privileged enough to do something that you're doing, to see what's, you know, underwater. And my son is he's been in the army now for 4 and a bit years, and one of the things that he wants to do when he comes out of the army is set up his own like diving company. He's really into that, and I wasn't, and I thought, well, crikey, you know. And then you start paying a bit of interest to it, and you think, how fascinating is it to actually see what's, when I look at the Solent, How deep is the Solent? When you look across to Portsmouth and Southampton, how deep is it? Have you been in there?
Oh, yeah, I've worked all over, right around the island, thousands and thousands of hours on the bottom. But there's a channel that runs in the middle, you know, the shipping channel where you see the big ships go through. That goes down to about 30 metres, 100 feet, if you like.
Yeah.
And all the rest is anywhere between sort of 10 metres up to about 15, 20 metres. It's difficult to say without stating a particular area. But it's fascinating. You hit the nail on the head there where you said, you know, we know what's going on in space and millions of light years away, and yet you can go on that ferry and you can look down and there may be something only 100 feet below you that's never been looked at.
Yeah.
And that's what's so fascinating is to... And you said you got it right when you said it's a privilege. I've always considered myself that I've had 50 years privilege of actually going down and entering the time capsule and touching history, which you may be the first person to touch that item in 500 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a very special feeling.
I've often gone on a ferry across and thought, I wonder how deep it is. Is it here? What would happen if we were to sink, or, you know, would we be able to, you know, because how deep is it going to be, and so on and so forth? And the more I think about it, the more fascinating it becomes. Obviously, a little bit scary as well. When you go down in the water, you know, deep 30 meters, whatever. What are you in? Are you in a capsule? Or are you just
no? That's just free diving. I mean, when we worked in the North Sea, obviously we were working. We lived under pressure in chambers, talking like Donald Duck for a month, and you actually spent a month inside like a little underwater space capsule, if you like, but built into the ship, and then you commute down in a diving bell. Well, we were working down to 180 metres, sort of 600 feet depth total, sometimes less, so, you know, mainly in the middle, about 400 feet. But now, in normal diving, normal what you'd say recreational diving, or even the diving that we do now, we tend to only be in a dry suit and, you know, with a cylinder on your back and whatever mask, if you had communications, whatever. So it's pretty basic stuff.
So how often do you dive now?
Well, whenever the weather allows. You know, if the weather was brilliant today, I probably would have been out there. But I tend to get out there whenever I can. It's not so much as before, because the weather patterns are different and the visibility around the Isle of Wight underwater is a lot worse than it used to be because of all the dredging that's gone on in Portsmouth and Southampton. It's very murky most of the time, but it. You know, when you grab the chance, you know, if you get a couple of good days in a row, you go out and stay out for overnight and just do as much diving as you can while the weather conditions allow. So whenever it's good, I'll be out there, really.
Okay. You must dive elsewhere, not just around the island. I bet you go on diving holidays as well, don't you?
No, that's like a bit of a busman's holiday. I don't do it when I go on holiday, but I've worked all over the world. You know, I've worked. We had an operation in the Far East for 20 years. That's only just come to an end in recent years. We had a ship out there. We dived all over the Philippine Islands, Indonesia, Vietnam, you know, America, all over South America. Basically, just about not everywhere, because it's impossible to dive everywhere. Mm. But a lot of countries, Cape Verde Islands, all sorts of places, because there are various sort of hotspots for shipwrecks that you know, places that. There were a lot of shipwrecks that occurred in those rough areas, so that's the areas you tend to home in on.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a silly question, because I'm now, in my mind, I've gone back to childhood mode and thinking, I can see you with a map with a cross on it. Where do you go, and what tells you where you've got to go and dive? You know, where to, right, I've got to go there, because the rumour is that something went down here all those years ago and I'm going to go and try and find it.
Yeah, it's a good question, that, because, you know, you do have a map, and I've got a map with a lot of crosses on, because you've always got targets that you're looking for and perhaps never found. I mean, we will look for one massive Manila galleon, which was full of incredible stuff, in the Philippines, and we spent 3 years looking for that but never found it. It was just too difficult, too deep, and just a hard one. But if you do it systematically, I mean, we're fortunate now that people can just go on Google and they can just look up whatever they want to look up. If they put in a ship's name, it may come up with a photograph and the history of the ship on Wikipedia or whatever. In the early days, we used to have to go up to London, and I'd have to go up and do research in the libraries up there, or in the Kew Gardens, or the PRO, places like that. And then you come back, and then you make a plan and try and assess where a ship sinks. or has sunk, and systematically search that area. And but it's a lot easier now than it was then. We've got much more sophisticated electronics to actually go searching, where you actually get a picture on the seabed. And also we've got a couple of the little robots with a camera and manipulator and that you can send down before you dive. So it's a lot easier now.
What was the last thing you found and like, you know, went, wow, this is great?
Oh, that's a hard one. People always ask that, and I love all items equally. I mean, so I brought you in some items today just to give you an example, but I still find, you know, gold coins now and again, and silver coins and things like that. They don't particularly excite me because it's the old pieces of eight stuff. I've got some here. They don't particularly excite me because they're not personal, but the personal items really I love. You know, it's the wacky items that appeal to me, something someone made, or that you think, well, that some guy made. It's like these little cannons I've got here. Somebody made a model on a ship in the first decade of the 1700s, and all the remains of that ship and the models are a few scattered remains buried in the seabed, and these were all buried in the seabed. But someone actually made a model of the ship they were on, and made all these little guns, turned them up on a little hand lathe, and they're actually to scale the guns of the ship that he was on, and that was, what, 300 years ago, almost exactly 300 years ago. So
when you showed me them, I thought they were bullets.
No, they're little guns that, you know, they are actually scaled up to the same.
So when you find this, and you know, this is, yeah, see, I would have thought that was a bullet, but it's not, obviously. It's a cannon,
yeah.
So how many have you got there?
Got about 15. There's some in the museum still. I've just been cleaning them up, going through and databasing and cleaning stuff up.
And what is it? Is it brass?
Yeah, it's bronze. It's bronze. Yeah,
bronze.
Yeah.
So how many have you got there?
Got about a dozen here. I found about 16 altogether. But that was over the space of about 25 years.
Oh, they are slightly different as well.
Yeah, they're not all in one place, and they're probably spread over the. You know how volatile it is on the back of the island. You get a storm down there, you really know it. So it's pretty much about a football field, that sort of area. And then if you systematically work through it over the years, when you get the conditions, then you'll come across these things buried. They're always buried. That's the interesting thing, and you just work with a metal detector and just dig up the seabed, basically.
Crikey. Because obviously you can go there and then go there a week later and
it'll be somewhere else.
And it'll be somewhere else, depending on how much wind and stuff we've had.
It's unbelievable. You see pieces of ship, iron ship, that can get moved, several tons of iron, and you'll see them be moved like 50 yards after a storm.
Wow.
It is amazing. But it's history, and it's fascinating stuff to me. I love bits of wood. I mean, that piece of wood there is 200 years old. It's oak, and it's a solid, yeah, it's like iron. It's been underwater for 200 years, and there it is off a famous ship, an East India ship off Bembridge. And it's just fascinating that all these pieces tell a story. Structures of, you know, like the bottom of a ship. I get excited about wood, you know, the remains of a wooden ship, because you can see how they built it and how it was put together and how does it survive. It's amazing how some things survive. So
there's so many things I've got to ask you. I mean, first of all, you better take them back, because I'll put them in the pocket otherwise and go home with them. When you've found something like that, how do you can you then trace it back to a particular boat time?
Normally that's the big thing for me, because I don't sort of find things and then declare them, and I declare them, but I don't rush to the auction house, because having a museum, I've put everything in the museum so other people get the benefit of seeing it.
Yeah,
you know, it'd be very nice. The accountant said many times, why don't you sell all that stuff? And I couldn't bring myself to do it, because it's local heritage.
Yeah,
and it's like a moral obligation that you're a custodian. You're a custodian of the stuff, even though it's my material. I found it. It's, you know, the public have got a right to be able to see these things, because as time goes on, there will be less and less stuff coming up from the seabed that can actually learn from. And that's why the trust that we've just merged with the Maritime Archaeological Trust, they're based in Southampton, and they've come in with us on the museum to promote that and also bring it forward so that it can become an accredited museum and go on to better things, you know, because my kids have all got careers and they, you know, museums aren't a money-making thing, they're a labour of love and it's a personal passion of mine. So it's great that the Trust has now come on board with us. But, you know, you find the things, you declare them, and it goes through a system called the Receiver Rec, which is a perfectly legal system that they try and track down an owner. And if they can't find an owner after a certain time, then it reverts back to you, especially with us being a museum. It's a fascinating process, and to answer your question about the, you look into it. That's the one of the best things of the lot is to actually research it and fill in all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle and track down what the ship was. You know, you might start off with only one little basic clue, and then you track down what it was, where it was going, what it was carrying, and there's some fascinating stories behind that. I found some very old stuff, which I'll show you in a minute, of about 700 years old, back to about 1300, 1400 era. And I found a ring on there, a gold ring with a seal on it. And I found two, actually. One I managed to track down the actual family in Cornwall that the guy who lost the ring has had his initials on the inside. So I know his name from hundreds of years ago. But I don't know why he was on that ship. I don't know what ship it was on. It was just something I found completely randomly as I was doing systematic searching. So sometimes that's very frustrating to not be able to get the complete answer, but most of the time I do.
So do you have a team of people or is it just you that finds out all these details?
Yeah, it's the royal we. I get nagged a lot about saying we. Well, yeah, mostly it's me that does the research and me that does the diving, but occasionally you have other people with you, and obviously you've got to have other people on the boat. So it is a bit of a team effort sometimes, but nowadays doing shipwreck work, you don't really need more than two or three of you on board. So
not
when we had the bigger boat, it sometimes varied a bit on that.
So is it fair to say that most of the stuff, if not all of the stuff that's in the museum itself, you've brought up from the sea?
Yeah, pretty much. All the things that you see that have been recovered from wrecks, especially around the Isle of Wight, then that is stuff that I found personally. But obviously we have little bits and pieces that some people lend, like ship models and a few items that are on loan from the National Maritime Museum.
I'm going to bring in Toby in a minute, because I'm sure he's got some questions.
Yes, yeah,
if we were to rock up at whatever time, how long would it take us to walk around the museum properly, to have a good look around?
How long would it take? That's a very good question, because some people are in and out of there in 15 minutes and some people take 5 hours. It depends on their level of interest, really. And this is where we try to sort of aim it at everybody, so it's not just aimed at enthusiasts of shipwreck material. There are activities for children. They can come and do treasure hunts. They get a prize at the end of it, and there's all sorts of activities for children, which flags up on things like TripAdvisor that people have enjoyed that aspect of it. Some other people will take 5 hours going round.
Now, you've already been round, haven't you?
Yeah.
So you've been round twice?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Enjoy it?
Yeah, it was good, actually, yeah.
Good. Okay. Got a question?
I actually have a question I didn't write down, but I looked on your photos and you had your big, I don't know what it's called, but it's a massive outfit that is quite old, and it had the helmet over it. Did you actually use that?
I did, right at the very beginning. In fact, there's some photographs in the museum that when we set up the museum in 1978, the local, I think it was the Weekly Post. It was the Weekly Post. Do you remember the Weekly Post?
Yeah, I do.
And they asked us to do a reenactment to prove that our old diving equipment worked. Now, I used that in the very early times of when I started diving in the 60s. I was on one job where that was just being phased out, so we got a chance to use it once, and then it was after that it was the more modern gear. But it's great fun to use, and I actually belong to a thing called the Historical Diving Society, and where there's a group of old last of the summer wine divers like me that go around and use that just for fun, you know, with a hand pump. And in that 78 one, we used it in Bembridge Harbour with a hand pump, and had people pumping it down, and I went up and down the ladder, and it's great fun. I mean, it's called C.B. Gorman standard diving equipment.
Yeah. Is that it?
That's it.
That's
yeah.
it there, is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's some of the helmets I got in the 70s.
So I'm looking at it now. You can go to the website and have a look at it yourself, but I look at that and I think of Del Boy.
Yeah,
I do. I think of Del Boy because he actually wore one of those in one something like that anyway, in one particular episode.
Did he?
And what makes me think now is the people that were obviously on the set, they would have had to have gone and got something like that.
Yeah.
And they would have come to somebody like you,
yeah.
that, and you would have borrowed it, and Del Boy would have worn it.
Yeah.
And I think it was all about water. The episode that I'm referring to is all about water and dumping stuff, and he had to wear some kind of thing.
I didn't see that one, but I can imagine. I can probably give you the name of the guy that probably had the gear, because I bought the gear off of a chap that used to work up at Pinewood Studios,
right.
and he supplied a lot of that stuff for the films, and I've got one of his helmets in the museum.
Wow.
Yeah, which is a tinned one, but yeah, I never saw that episode, but I can imagine it, I can picture it.
See, I'm now picturing the Isle of Wight, which probably would have been years ago. Lots of pirates and things like that going on around the island.
There's masses of history. I mean, it never ceases to fascinate me. If I can find any information about something I hadn't read about before, about the activities of the people on the back of the Wight, they talk about wreckers and. But, you know, the people on the back of the Isle of Wight were the same people that used to help people off wrecks and were supposed wreckers.
Mm.
They were longshoremen that actually used to risk their lives to help people ashore from shipwrecks or try and save them before the lifeboats came on the back of the island in 1860. And then after 1860, there were the same guys that went and manned the lifeboats and the rowing lifeboats and went out and saved the people there. And they had horrendous times. I mean, if you read about all that, the local history is just amazing.
Yeah, we're steeped in it, and yet when they keep making program after program and drama after drama about other things on the mainland, and you think if someone was to just write something about the Isle of Wight, it would really put it on the map in a really positive way.
It would,
you know, because all this stuff that's just there.
It is.
I'm surprised nobody's done anything about Carisbrook Castle, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, and this is the unseen, isn't it?
Yeah. We actually went down the bottom of Carisbrook Castle well in 1970 for the Department of the Environment to try and dig out all the masses of pennies and things.
Oh, crikey!
And that's about 100, and, I think it was 180 feet to the bottom, and with a 60 foot of water or something like that.
Pitch
black. But it was just a solid mass of money because people have. Generations have thrown coins down the bottom.
Yeah. Wow. Jeez. That's incredible. Yeah. And I suppose they couldn't have been used or banked or anything like that because they were in such a state.
It shows you how thick we only scraped the surface because they decided that health and safety started creeping in then, and they decided it was probably not a good idea to go back and do it. But we had a 1969 penny in the third sack full down. So, you know, if you can imagine, that was probably about that thick. And 1 year old penny was in the bottom one. It was probably 15 feet thick of money down there.
Wow.
And everything you can imagine, toy snakes, now. You know, sunglasses.
Come on, let's go back down.
I'd love to.
Yeah.
I'd love to. Yeah.
What would they say if you said now, can we do that? Would they say no, you can't? Health and safety says no.
Yeah, a few years ago it was done again. I went there when the team came from the mainland. They were cave divers, I think, that they managed to get permission to go down there again. But I don't think they actually recovered anything. They just maybe that I can't remember now, but it was done.
What's the, because you're a diver, so what's the scariest thing? You must have had some, scary moments where you think, oh, this is it then.
Well, yeah, you do, but I always equate that with, when we were in the North Sea, we lost quite a few people in the early 70s because the technology was such that it was just getting into mixed gas, helium, deep diving with bells and things, and there were quite a few deaths, and we lost a few mates up there, but... Then you've got to compare it with how many mates did you lose in car accidents, and it sort of levels out. And now, the North Sea diver, you never hear any, it's so safe. Even in the time that I was there, it was starting to get really safe with the deep saturation diving, where everything was monitored, and it was much safer than it was before because the technology was getting better understood. But yeah, you do have moments, but then, like I say, you might have moments going around Coppins Bridge, might.
And might about it.
Yeah. But I've had a few, but yeah, here I am after 50 years of doing it, touch wood. So fingers crossed, I'll still be doing it till I'm about 90, until they drag me out with rigor mortis, I think.
Now, do you know, there's an interesting guy that is along for Fairley Road, and he does the Post Office Museum. You might have heard us talking about it, Arthur. And he has, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of post boxes. And whenever you go up there, he'll tell you a story about each and every one. I'm just picturing you in the museum, because you've brought most of this up, or if not, you know, most of all of this stuff up from the sea, from the bottom of the sea, and you must have a story to tell about every single piece. So are you there most of the time?
No, I'm not, because I still got a lot of other things going on, you know, work-wise, with diving and marine work and things. So I get there when I can, and it's a bit of a relief now that the trusts are getting involved, because that means I still go up there and clean the brass with the good old volunteers that got a couple of volunteers plus the trust volunteers as well. They all do a great job helping with that. But yeah, every time we go up there, and it is strange, because when you look in all the cases, a porthole is the naval people listening will say it's not a porthole, it's a scuttle. That's called what they call them in the in the Navy. But for Joe Bloggs, you know, the layman, a porthole is a porthole. And yet I can look at virtually any porthole up there and remember which ship it came off. Now, that is really strange. It even makes me feel that I must be a bit of an anorak, you know, to be able to remember where they come from, where they all come from. But every time I look in there and clean things in the cases, there's items in there that just all tell a story. I mean, if I showed you that, what would you think that was?
Hang on, we better just can you describe that, Toby?
What they're putting the bull's nose.
Yeah, that was thinking that as well. What are those things?
That's a good description, but that was actually a worthless piece of bronze that looks like a little bracelet, but it's too small to go on a wrist. But there were bigger ones. But that was what they called a Manila, and they manufactured these in the millions and shipped them out to Africa, and traded that for one human being, one slave, and took it, and then took the slave across the West Indies, sold them a huge profit, and then came back with either money, gold or silver. We got some of the slave money, you know, the ingots and gold nuggets, and that would be what was called the triangular route. But that worthless piece of bronze was one human being. Can you believe that?
Wow.
It's a really sad trade. So every little item tells a story, and you know, I love it. I mean, I still look into cabinets and I see things and I think, oh, I forgot about that. And then you remember the story about it, and you want to tell everybody in the best way you can, but there's so many things in there that it's difficult to find all the room to put labels on. But the trust are coming up with a new method now, which will make that a bit more possible.
Okay. When we turn up, because I'm going to come and have a look.
Oh, you've got to come.
But I'd like you to be there and talk us through it.
I'd definitely come and.
Because we're probably going to be there about 5 hours, Toby. That's the thing, because I want the full works. I want the story on everything.
Bring your sleeping bag if you want.
Yeah. Honestly, I just find it really fascinating, and you are the man to do. Have you ever thought about, like, you know, doing some voiceover so people can push buttons and get the items?
Yes, we thought about that, and you know, museums are a question of survival, and several museums like ours around the country have shut down. In fact, we're one of the few survivors. And when museums shut down, there was a very good one in Weymouth, and it had all the interactive stuff, you know, with talking heads and everything like that, which I managed to acquire, but they'd all sort of stopped working by that time. So if there's any people listening out there that love playing with things to make them work again, you can come and help us do that. Because we've thought about touchpads, and that may happen fairly soon, and the sort of hands-on stuff, you know, press button stuff, I'm quite happy to do that. And and also the trust have got a lot of people, MAT, who are dedicated to certain things, you know, that they can do the social media, or they can do interactive stuff, or they can do databasing. It's a very good trust, and I'm really pleased that we've managed to merge with them now.
So when you go out and have a look down the old, underneath the sea, so to speak, do you sort of tell anybody where you're going? Do you have to sort of keep it a bit of a secret? Because if people see you diving there, do they think,
that's a good question.
There must be something, let's have a go down there.
I was talking about this very subject the other day, and it's a very good question, that, because, if you are within sight of the coast, which we often are, you know, with the closer in wooden wrecks and things, then you do get people watching where you go, and to compensate for that, or to get over it, I tend to go and dive on pieces of sand, you know, so if they're watching and they want to go and dive where I dived, they can go and dive on all the things, places they think I was, but only one out of maybe 10 of them will be just working on something. The rest will be pieces of sand.
So that's a bit sad.
It's called red herring.
It's a bit sad. You've got to be a bit sort of sneaky and watch your back, isn't it?
Well, it doesn't happen a lot. It did a few years ago, not so much now, but obviously people are always looking where you go. I mean, my philosophy on that is if people put the time in and spend the sort of hours that I have done over the years, looking in areas that I haven't looked in, they will find things that, like someone so rightfully said once, where there's a reef, there's a wreck. And that was very true, because in the old sailing ship days, it wasn't like today where they just steam in a straight line. They could only go where the wind let them go. So any onshore winds and storms drove a lot of things in. But there's plenty there for everyone. I mean, I would never dream of going and going somewhere where I knew someone else was working or diving. There's enough for everyone there.
That's a respect thing, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
That's your age.
Yes, it's the age. The old generational thing.
We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to chat some more, and we're going to talk more about the museum as well.
Okay.
Because you mentioned parking earlier on, so we'll talk about parking as well, because that's important.
Mm.
We'll take a quick break, then we'll come back, and we'll chat some more. It's 12:36. This is FM 104.6.
At heart, this is Vectis Radio, FM 104.6.
Did you have a good day with Grandpa yesterday?
Yeah, we went to the Shipwreck Centre and Maritime Museum with Tarleton Barnes. It was amazing. They had loads of things down deep under the sea.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like gold and silver coins, old diving suits, and a real mermaid. I even did a treasure hunt and got a prize.
That sounds great. Did Grandpa have fun?
He loved it, and he loved the free parking.
That sounds like Grandpa.
The Shipwreck Centre and Maritime Museum, a real flavour of the maritime world. For more, go to shipwreckcentre.com.
A missing child, a murder. In a demanding, male-dominated world, WPC Villalli searches for clues, juggling career with her marriage and childcare. Policing's a tough job. Could you do it? Hold tight. I was hooked from page one, says Jill Kay, Ingenuity magazine. Michelle McGorrion, author of Goodnight, Mr. Tom, says, Hold Tight is fantastic, unputdownable. Hold Tight by Felicity Fair Thompson. Available online or from your favourite bookshop.
Jewson, the national name with a local heart. We see the Four P's Project as a fantastic opportunity for young people to gain valuable life skills and receive opportunities that may have passed them by. Congratulations to Vectis Radio for taking this initiative, a truly local community-based radio station. Jewson, the national name with a local heart. For kitchens and building materials, phone us on 525 111 or look for jewson.co.uk.
Squire's Barbershop are the longest serving barbers in Pyle Street. Open from 8:30 till 6:30 Monday to Thursday and until 7 p.m. on Fridays. Saturdays is an early start from 8 till 5. We now have a weekday family special, so you can save yourself pounds. Go and see Jay the Lardy Barber. He's back and ready to cut and style your hair. For a quality focused barbershop serving the local community, it has to be Squire's Barbershop, 68 Pyle Street, Newport. Get in, get trimmed, and go.
We are your Vectis Radio, FM 104.6.
Okay, then, welcome back. We've got Martin in from the Shipwreck Centre that moved from Bembridge to Arrowton Barnes, and we've just been shown some gold coins. You did get them all back, didn't you?
I'm just counting now.
Because you've got a young lady. Where are you from? From Ryde, isn't
it?
Yeah. Yeah, a bit dodgy in Ryde.
Yeah, they are.
He did give them back, didn't he? Because there were some gold ones and some silver ones as well.
Yeah.
The gold one was really, like, flat.
Yeah, there's two different types of coins. That one that I showed you is, like, 700 years old. And it's what they called a hammered coin, and they would hammer it really flat and then sort of put a die on it and punch it. Later on, they cut them out of it. They were concentrated much more with the Spanish coins on weight. So a coin would be chunky, much chunkier. Mm. So like the piece of eight there, that is just cut out of a piece of silver, and then they would trim it off and stamp it. And then that would have to be an exact weight weighed by the assayer. So it was quite technical, but the early gold coins, they vary a lot. But later on, the gold coins, the Spanish gold coins that we found, are like that, but in gold.
Right.
And the amazing thing about gold is, you know, people get gold fever. I've never had it, and I don't get it. But a lot of the American divers that I've worked with over there, they just go crazy about gold, finding gold coins. And the amazing thing about it is that a silver coin like that can end up... I think I bought a dirty one. I've just cleaned this big one.
Yeah.
But they get covered in verdigris and they get covered in marine growth. But a gold coin will come up just like someone threw it over yesterday. It might have been churning around on the seabed for 300 years. It'll come up really virtually perfect. It's weird.
I didn't think that would be the case. But when you said that, you know, you haven't cleaned that one at all, but that's
700 years underwater, and that's how it came up. It's not been cleaned.
700. Has it got a year on it?
I looked up the legend on there, and it's an Ecuador from 14. I think it's written on here. Where is it? There it is. It's an Ecuador, French Ecuador, and that is from 1328 to 1350, Philip VI de Valois.
Wow.
Yeah, and I found a few of them, actually.
So when you say a few, how many?
Oh, I can't tell you that on live.
Okay, all right. Don't live.
No, I'm joking.
You must have thought when you found one, there must be a chest in there somewhere.
Well, sometimes there is. I mean, on some of the wrecks we worked on abroad with other people and consortiums, you know, there's been thousands of coins come up. In Cape Verde, for instance, one wreck we worked on, 66,000 silver coins. And obviously the Cape Verdean government get most of that because everything is declared. Another wreck we worked on there, 4,000 silver coins. But there's been no massive finds around the Isle of Wight, what you call big finds, but
right.
I found a pretty, you know, much of a cross-section of all sorts of coinage over the years. But the gold ones are fascinating because they just survive so well. And they say about... some chemist told me once that nothing grows on gold because it's... I'm trying to remember the exact phrase she used... But it's an elemental thing where, you know, just vertebrae will not grow on it. There's some sort of property in there that it just stops it. You sometimes get a tiny little bit of what we call blue coral, a little tiny bit, but the rest of the time it comes up shiny. Amazing.
Now, I just want to point out how genuine you are, because here's a guy that goes down to the bottom of the seabed, puts his life on the line, and let's build it up a bit. and you bring all this stuff up to the surface. You've now got this wonderful museum that you put it all in, and your thought process is want to put it there so everybody can see it, don't want to sell it, don't want to make money out of it, I want people to see it. How much do you reckon if you were to sell one of those gold coins, how much would they be?
It depends which one you look at. Sometimes they're £1,000, sometimes they're several thousand, depending on the rarity. But I don't look at it like that. I should do. Sometimes in the past, you know, I mean, I'm all right now. I mean, commercial diving has been good to me. The North Sea was very lucrative. I didn't do it for that reason, but it was lucrative, and it enabled me to go out and do this in my time off, which is my real love. But as I said, the accountant has said to me many times over the years, when times are peaks and troughs, you know, when your finances go up and down, he said, well, if you sold all that, and I said, I can't do it. It's just not something I could do. I mean, I could go and, you know, sell a load that's legally mine, but, you know, it's, as I say, it's a moral obligation. I don't want to sit on a beach in Bahamas, or maybe I do, sipping large cocktails.
Stop, we're talking you into it now. You've got the devil in you now, haven't you? I just wanted to highlight how genuine you are, because, you know, some people, you know, that I'd be thinking, oh, do you know what? We could sell a few, go and have a nice holiday and so on. But no, everything is there and genuinely there for people to share, because that's what you're doing. Yeah. You're sharing your collection. That's a wonderful thing.
It's... Well, you know, I don't look at it as I don't look at the values of things that are in the museum. And the great thing about merging with the Trust now, the Southampton Trust, is they've got a lot of clout, a lot of connections. And with the accreditation that we hope will go through in the next couple of years, it'll mean that they can access grant funding and make it far better. I like to pride myself, if you look at the website, which we took a long time to put together.
It's a brilliant website.
I'm really
impressed with the website.
Yeah, it does the job, and it shows people what's there. But they can improve upon the social media side, and they can improve upon maybe the whole museum in time if they get grant funding, which would be great.
Do you know what's good about this? I'm going to bring you in a minute, Toby. So I hope you've got some questions. Yeah. I look at it and I think sometimes we think that we were the only persons on this planet. And when you see things like that, you realise that there were many, many people here before you and doing all these wonderful things. And things like this, it just brings it home to you, doesn't it? Because we very often just think it's just all about us. It's never about anybody else. And when you think you've got a gold coin there that's 700 years old. It's unbelievable. They had gold coins 700 years ago.
They had a lot earlier than that, too.
Incredible. So, question, Toby. Any?
I was going to say... probably be in your opinion, but what do you think is your most popular display there?
Oh, that's a difficult one. People always ask about what's the best thing you've ever found underwater, and it's so difficult because I love all of it, as you can tell by what I've been saying. But from the poignancy angle, there's two wrecks that I particularly you will have seen last year. There was a big centenary about a wreck called the Mendy. In Southampton, there was memorials there with Princess Anne, and we went out on a South African frigate. They brought all the relatives from South Africa up to this big centenary anniversary of this wreck. I found it in 1974. Now, when I found that wreck, it was supposed to be an Admiralty barge in the area, and I found it, and it was a big steamship, and I managed to identify it by a shipping crest on a plate. Cut a long story short, when I delved into it, there were 646 people died on that wreck just off the Isle of Wight. And we didn't know about it. None of us knew about it. 646, that's half the loss of the Titanic.
Yeah.
And we didn't know about it. And I researched nearly all the wrecks that I could find around the Isle of Wight, but never had this one flagged up. And it was a First World War loss. It was cut in half by another ship. And sadly, these troops, they were black South African troops, the Native Labour contingent, or Native Labour Corps, that were going up to Le Havre to dig trenches for the Allies in the war effort. Now, these guys were doing equally as much as anybody else fighting in the war, but they weren't allowed to carry a gun, they weren't allowed to carry a shovel or do labour work or drive trucks or whatever. And these people were completely forgotten. And thankfully, with that centenary, and over the years, the story has kept coming up. So that's one, Toby, and I'm sorry I'm ranting on so much. You haven't got a chance to get a word in, have you? That's one in particular that I love. And the other one is the submarine Swordfish, which also got lost off the Isle of Wight when it was supposed to be off the west coast of France. That 40 people died on that. Nobody knew about it. It was just off our shores when it was thought to be 250... miles away, and there's human elements. I've met the relatives of both wrecks. In fact, we're going down to South Africa in November, and I'll be going to the Soweto townships to meet some more of the descendants.
Wow,
fantastic story.
But you don't do much diving away from the island, because you think it's a labour of love or busman's holiday.
No, I don't do it for pleasure. I mean, I've done many projects.
Clear waters for you, it'd be better.
Yeah, but I've done many projects around the world, in different localities around the world. But it's been sort of working diving rather than pleasure diving. So for me to go away and get wet just for the sake of it, sometimes you go and snorkel or something, but you know, sometimes you want to do other things. I still love doing it, but of course most of the place you go to do it for pleasure, there would not be the same sort of significance or fines that we can find off our own back.
Joe, I don't know too many people that can do what you do, bring it back, put it there for people to see, and you don't get too, well, you, I suppose you get pleasure out of it. Of course you do.
Get pleasure, yeah.
But honestly, I'd be thinking, oh, do you know what, I might keep these gold coins. You know, it's, do you have the stuff that is you know, obviously going to be worth quite a bit? Do you have that locked away so people can't touch it and so
yeah.
on?
Yeah. Yeah, it's obviously in proper cases. But it's funny you should say about that. But in the early days of the museum, I never forget Dickie DeBell. Do you remember Dickie DeBell from Black Game Shine?
No.
He's still around. He's a lovely old gentleman. He always was a lovely gentleman. And he said to me back in the, when we first set up the museum, he said, you're missing the point. He came to one of our little, you know, we used to have this association of, we'd have meetings in each other's places. And he said, you know, you've just put on your advertising, oh, found by a local diver, but, you know, all the maritime stuff. He said, you're missing the point because people will relate to the fact that you've gone out there, you've found the wrecks, you've done the research, you've gone down, brought it up, cleaned it, put it in your own museum. And he was so right, because that's we did tend to push that point a bit more, and so many hundreds of people have said to me that have visited the museum, it's great to keep that, the fact that it's an individual and not an institution.
Yeah.
And the trust, the Maritime Trust, have kept that. You know, they've got a board there saying that the history of the museum, how it was all found, and people do like to relate that to but... And it's great to have that combination, really.
So what was the first thing that went on view? What was the first thing you ever brought up and thought, right, that's the first thing for the museum?
Oh, I think it was telegraph, like ship's telegraphs that still ring. One was off the Mendy, funnily enough, and it still rings. And there's a lovely display on the Mendy. And a lot of South African people come and visit for that reason. That's to answer that question, yeah. Toby, but you can never specify, you know, one item. I mean, rarity wise I found a mariner's astrolabe, which was very rare. It was only number 56 or 57 in the world at the time. But everything, every bit means something to me.
Yeah.
Any more questions there, Toby?
Yeah.
Oh, look, he's got a whole list for you.
Sorry, Toby.
We only got about 7 or 8 minutes, so go on, rattle through them. He's gone to sleep over there.
I got one more because we've kind of gone through all of them. But
okay, go on then.
In your opinion, why do you think it was a good idea to put the shipwreck museum on the island?
Well, the main reason for that, Toby, is that 95% of the stuff that I found and brought up and put in the museum is from the Isle of Wight. So, yeah. I mean, economically, it would do far, far better on the mainland because, as we all know, you know, there are less and less people come to the island now. But... you know, it's local history, so yeah. I've been offered various times to take it somewhere else on the mainland, but it's Isle of Wight history, and I'm no way am I going to move it off the Isle of Wight, and
good
hopefully
for you.
The trust feel the same.
Yeah. Good for you. Now, you moved it, obviously, from Bembridge to Ayrton, yes. And yeah, you kind of think, right, okay, well, you're moving from the coast inland, is that kind of, you know, detracting from what it actually is? And it hasn't, has it? Because I've got to be honest with you, I'm really impressed with Ayrton Barnes because it's grown over the last few years, and you're obviously a massive part of that. You know, you can go there and get lost there for probably the best part of the day, if not a couple of days.
Yeah.
And so it's worked out for you then?
Yeah, that's the whole point. I always have said that the more you can get into one complex, it makes it easier for the visitor to go to one place, one hit, and go there and do all the attractions on that place, have their lunch in the pub. It's free parking. It's something you mentioned earlier on.
Yeah.
Free parking there, which is another bonus, and they can do several things in one go. And that made sense. It's made no difference at all. I mean, you can't miss it. It's got one of our old lifeboats on the corner there, our old historic lifeboats, and it's a good place to spend a day.
I must admit, obviously watching it grow over the last couple of years, and the last couple of times I've gone down there, which is probably about 18 months ago, to eat, and it was incredibly busy. They actually opened up the car park on the field as well.
Yeah, they
and it was just packed solid with people, and there was just so many people milling around, not just going there to eat, but milling around and looking at other things as well. You know, there's so much there. Yeah. I remember doing an outside broadcast there for my former employers back in about 2003, something like that, 2004 maybe, and they used to do a breakfast thing there. So you'd be out in the gravel car park, and they had this thing there where they were cooking up a breakfast outside. And I remember going along there then and thinking, well, there ain't much here, is there? And obviously, over the years, it's grown. And it is. Yeah. It's a place that people now talk about with great affection.
It's a central location, too. That's the advantage. That somewhere where you can go and park with no problem at all and see a lot of different things. And it's variety.
What I'm also impressed with as well, I won't go into too much detail because we can't do too much detail, but what I'm impressed with is the cost as well. I'm impressed with prices to get in.
Yes.
I think it's it really is. You'd expect it to be a lot more money than that. All your hard work, it should be.
Well, you've got to pitch it at the right level. I mean, basically, a lot of Arrowton is free, you know, the attraction's there, but we have to charge, otherwise we couldn't survive.
Sure.
But we've tried to pitch it at a level that's remained the same for a few years. And, you know, to me, over the years, it's only been a question of the museum surviving and just keeping its head above water, to coin a phrase. And if it does that, and hopefully now the Trust can take it on much further, and improve it in lots of ways. They've got these 3D visualization, and you know, you can actually put on these goggles and be in a shipwreck and things like that, and all the First World War history of sunken ships. They've done a study on that over the last few years. So there's a lot of variety, especially also for kids.
So is there a specific day that you might be there sort of just talking people through a few things, or have we got to book you for that?
No, I'll always come there. I'll give you my number, give me a call. But I mean, I end up spending ages talking to people, because if I'm there cleaning the brass or doing a little bit of work or something, it's great to interact with the public and get their views on what interests them and how they like the displays. I'll go there any time you want, if you just give me a ring. If I'm not underwater, that is.
I don't really want to go. Do you fancy some underwater stuff?
Yeah.
would that appeal to you?
Yeah, it sounds good, actually.
Is it a trade that people get into? Are there more and more people doing it, or is it a bit too scary for the youngsters today?
Well, as a job, it's not a good way to go now, because the good days are gone. When I was in the North Sea, it was a booming industry. When I first started in the diving industry, there were only a couple of hundred people in it in England. Then that went to several thousand. And then as the legislation tightened up, it was very expensive to get courses for people who wanted to get into it. And, of course, the oil industry is suffering a bit of a lapse now with the price of oil so low. So a lot of people are out of work. So vocationally, it's probably a good thing to do. But for something to do as a hobby, you can't beat it. I never tire of it. You're in another world.
Yeah.
It's a different world. It's a silent world. And you see all sorts of things. Yeah, and it's just great.
In the summer, a lot of the time, like you do diving, me and Dad will go to Compton or somewhere like that, and we'll go bodyboarding
today. Yeah, it's great.
Really
great.
Good.
Yeah, be careful of that wreck there that sticks up.
Yeah.
So there's a picture of that. That is that you?
That's me.
That's
with
you.
Hair.
That's you. Well, I wasn't going to say that.
Grass doesn't grow on busy streets. No, that was in '78 when we did that thing I was telling you about the promotion thing for the Weekly Post. That's Weekly Post stuff. Yeah.
Wow. Honestly, I could talk to you all day. There's so much stuff here that. You know, and I'm looking at the amount of brass you've got to clean as well. How long does it take you to clean all of that then?
Quite a long time. But I've got some good help.
Do you need more help?
Yeah,
you can. Because Toby would say he'd
plenty of rubber gloves.
I thought you volunteered earlier. Yeah.
Yeah. He's saying, what did you say, Toby? No, you do it.
Yeah, you do it. Yeah. Honestly, I could talk to you all day. There's so much stuff, so we're going to have to come and have a little look. At what you do. I mean, it is incredible. Just looking at hundreds and hundreds of little pictures now of the things that you've actually brought up. There's so much there. When you get, there's a bell. I'm looking at a big bell now. How heavy? I'm guessing that's heavy.
Which one are you looking at? We've got about 38 bells, I think.
Oh, really? That's only probably a little one, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a small one.
So how much would that weigh then?
That's off a ship called the Gerarda, from that little bell, from memory. I'm just looking at it from over here. It's only a small one, about that big, but we've got bells that are that big and you can hardly lift.
Yeah.
So, and that's one of the questions for the kids, is go count the bells. How many bells can you see?
Right.
And they go around and do all these little quizzes, and they come out, get a prize, and they're happy. And so many parents have said, I'm so glad we brought the kids here, because they really enjoyed it. Because a lot of kids don't want to do it now, they just want to get on the iPad, don't they?
So, yeah.
So how do you get a big, you're talking a bell that's quite big there, how do you get that out then? Is that a big operation?
Yeah, bells are really strange, because normally you always know where they are on the ship, where they're supposed to be on the ship, but inevitably they end up...
Oh, crikey, we've run out of time. Look at the time, we've got to go. Thanks for being there.